Welcome to the Clinical Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, we are able to make science more accessible and understandable.
All right, welcome everyone to the June 2025 edition of the Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Special thank you again to our sponsors, Limmer Education and ESO, for making it possible for us to be here together today. I'm Rimley Crow, and today I am joined by Jeff Rollman, Michael Caduce, and Dr. Bill Toon. And we are very excited and fortunate to have with us from the authorship team of this paper, Jonathan Powell and Chris Gage. As a reminder for those of you at home who are following along, the article that we are reviewing in today's Journal Club is National Evaluation of Emergency Medical Services, Clinician Burnout with Workforce Reducing Factors. And this is hot off the press in JCEP Open. The open part meaning that anyone can access the paper free of charge. So encourage you to check out the full paper, and we will be bringing in lots of great questions regarding it. So as always, our discussion is paired with an article written by our very own columnist, Michael Caduce, in EMS World that is under a section called Journal Watch. And I encourage all of you to check it out, emsworld.com, under Education and Training. And to those of you who are tuning in live today, I want to thank you, first of all, and remind you that you can use that chat feature on your screen. And if you type in questions and comments, we can bring those into the conversation with us as we go. So without further ado, I want to welcome our guest. We're talking about an important topic today that hits close to home for many, burnout in the EMS workforce. And I mean, let's face it, a lot of us have felt this level of burnout in the field, but the question then becomes, how widespread is it? Has it worsened after COVID? What impact is it having on our ability to keep EMS clinicians actually in the workforce? And so to help us answer this, we have with us two special guests. So I'd like to give a warm welcome to Jonathan Powell and Christopher Gage, who are co-authors on this paper. So Jonathan and Chris, thank you for taking the time to join us today.
Hey, Rimley. Excited to be here with y'all.
Most definitely.
All right. So before we dive straight into the paper, I always think it's great for the audience to have the opportunity to get to know you a little bit. So I'd love it if you could tell us a little bit about who you are, what you're doing, and how you got involved in EMS research. So Jonathan, I'll go ahead and start with you.
Yeah, sure. So, I feel like I definitely probably followed kind of a traditionalist path in my my EMS, career. Started off as a clinician, went and became a educator after spending, 5-6 years in rural Alabama on the ambulance. And then I ended up getting the chance to go to the National Registry and spent some time as an EMS research fellow, which really kind of allowed me to take all of the information that I learned in the field and take that higher education and kind of apply it to research. So then you take that thought process of being an EMS clinician, seeing all of these things happening in the field from burnout to patient care, and then really getting the tools to learn how to ask questions about it and how to look at it from a scientific standpoint. And so I like to think, from bouncing around Clark County, Alabama, to working in Columbus, Ohio, with some very incredibly talented researchers that were, that I'm thankful or happy to invest into me. That's kind of been my process, from the ambulance to the research space, trying to take what I've learned at every single space and really apply it and really ask some questions and get some good answers.
All right. Tell us about your work today.
Yeah, so today we're looking at essentially burnout in the EMS care setting, right? We're looking at EMS clinician burnout and what type of impacts that burnout might have on the workforce and workforce stability. So going from the clinician mindset of running every single day and putting yourself into these very high stress situations, it's not the easiest thing on a clinician's well-being and mental well-being without taking some really targeted steps to try to intervene on that. And so Chris and I, we really wanted to get an idea of what was going on in terms of EMS clinician burnout and the impact that that might have on the field and the stability of the workforce. And
go ahead,
Erwin.
It's such an interesting way that we wind up on these roads and looking at this topic that's obviously so important to both of us. And I want to make sure that we give a chance to Chris to introduce himself as well and how he got interested in EMS research and in the topic of today at hand. So, Chris.
Okay. Yeah. So I started my EMS career back in 2003. I actually am a paramedic 2005. I've spent time, working on the truck, working in critical care services, stuff like that. I taught for a long time. I actually got my master's degree and presented my project at the PCRF Research EMS World in Atlanta. And Dave Page stood up and said, "Hey, if you guys like research, you should go check out the National Registry. They have a cool opportunity in Columbus, Ohio." So I called my wife and I said, "Do you want to go to Columbus, Ohio?" And I had failed my first research project because I had not done my work. And she said, "Absolutely not." So long story short, change of minds. And here we are 3 years later. Yeah, like Jonathan said, you come up here, you start working with people that are just amazing. Osh Panchal is our medical director up here. He just does so much work and so many things. And, just working and understanding EMS clinicians, their satisfaction, their leaving, their burnout, the different things that they go through with their different patient care and stuff like that. It's really been eye-opening, an experience.
It is
Chris,
definitely eye-opening.
I think you and I had a similar experience whenever I broached the thought process of moving to Columbus. My partner also had a similar reaction. It's getting past that first hump and getting past one of many jumps into getting into the research field.
Oh, yeah.
And meanwhile, I got bamboozled and was interviewed on a very sunny day in Columbus, Ohio.
Well, that doesn't sound like the norm.
I could probably look that one up.
Yeah, I think it. Yeah, I was like, I think you can count them on one hand.
Yeah.
So, for those in the audience who wonder what is happening, so Jonathan, Chris, and I are all products of a really unique educational opportunity at the National Registry of EMTs. And Dr. Tony Fernandez is also a product of this program, though he is on a well-deserved break and probably applying what he learned from Jonathan and Chris's paper to fight burnout. But this NREMT research fellowship program is a truly unique opportunity in a way that the registry is giving back to the mission of creating a cadre of trained research professionals. So perhaps Jonathan or Chris, you could talk just a little bit about what that program looks like.
Yeah, I can talk about it. You come up here, you actually start in June. That's kind of the start date. August of that year, you actually start into the PhD program. I'm in epidemiology. I think Rimley was, Jonathan was, I think everybody pretty much is. Actually, our new fellow from last summer, he is actually in health policy. His name's Jacob Kamholtz. So he's our first one to kind of step outside the epidemiology. We actually have a new oncomer. I will hold her name right now, but she's a new oncomer that gets ready to start next Monday. You'll hear all about her. She also is going to be going into epidemiology, I think. So it's about a 4-ish to 5-ish year process. And you pretty much do high level research. You come in immediately. We've already have a structure of, what they're going to be analyzing and writing, and it's constant. I think I've published about 30-ish papers since I've been here, been on the list of them. Yeah, it just grows every year. And the more you work with more people, the more they just are publishing, and you work with them. We work with states and different stakeholders, and so it's just an experience you cannot get outside of this place right now. It's just an experience that's untouchable for EMS clinicians.
Definitely an amazing and unique experience. So, for those of you thinking about it, keep it on the radar. Keep an eye on that NREMT website. Perhaps dip your toes in the water with a research workshop. I know Jonathan just got back from one of those, as well as Jeff. So, lots of opportunities to get involved, but can't understate how important it is for EMS clinicians to be involved in work like this. And turning back to today's work, we heard a little bit about what got you interested in this project. But I really want to dive in to the decision to follow this work. So, for those who have not had the opportunity to see the article yet, the goal of the present study was really to look at current EMS clinician burnout and how that relates to things that reduce our workforce, meaning things like sickness absence or actually leaving the workforce turnover. So, curious to hear from you all. What made you decide to take on this study and why now? How did the pandemic potentially factor into this decision?
Yeah, so the strength and stability of the EMS workforce has been a concern for the past 10 years. I can't think of a time whenever someone's not saying we need to think about the workforce. We need to look at the workforce. We need to measure the workforce. And a lot of times those types of comments can just go out into the ether and then nothing really happens. And so one thing that I've been very thankful for is through the relationship that we have with the National Registry, we actually have the ability to track rather well-detailed workforce characteristics by using the National Registry profile. So over 500,000 EMS clinicians are located in this database, and it's one of the largest repeatably accessible databases of EMS clinician information in the United States. And so through the access with the National Registry, we've been able to really do some of that detailed measurement and projections when it comes to using the workforce. And so one of the natural steps were, well, where are we losing clinicians? Where are we having a weakness in that workforce so that we can try to think of interventions that would lead to a strengthened and more stable workforce? And, Rimley, some of the work that you did during your time during the fellowship back in 2015, 2016, specifically looked at the question of burnout. And you all measured burnout within the EMS clinician population and looked at it within reference to some workforce characteristics. Now, since 2015, 2016, we've had a couple things happen within the EMS clinician community, namely COVID within 2020. And some of the work that Chris has done has shown in the past how COVID has actually changed some of the drivers of leaving and staying in the workforce, whereas pay might not be as important as it once was, and job satisfaction might be much more important. And so, with some of these shifting pieces and what's important, what's not important, or what's less important in the workforce, we really wanted to revisit some of the work that you did previously, Rimley, and measure again burnout post the COVID-19 pandemic. Get an idea of what might have happened since the first time that we measured it prior to the pandemic, and how those workforce relations might have changed, and how burnout might now be associated in a different way with remaining in the workforce or workforce stability. And so, really, this was kind of a status check. We took a look at it way back when in 2015, 2016, and we want to make sure that the lessons that we learned then with your good work are still there now. And if they're not, then what's changed, and how do we pivot as an organization, as a community, to really address these workforce issues. So that's really what kind of made this happen, is we saw the good work that was done before, we recognized that the playing field now is different than it was then, and we really needed to do an update and to get an idea of what's going on currently within the EMS workforce.
And while it hurts me to recognize that that work was almost a decade ago at this point, that was part of my dissertation as part of the National Registry Fellowship that we mentioned. And this is a really good time to point out why it's important to set up repeatable methods because we want something to serve as a baseline and to have the follow-up. So it was very exciting to me when Jonathan and Chris took on this study to say, all right, what has changed in the past 9-ish years? And we'll get into those results soon, but we do need to talk through some of the methodology and the way that we know that we're not just getting an apples to apples comparison across these two time frames, that we're really seeing a Granny Smith apple to a Granny Smith apple. And so to help us explore some of the methodology, I'm going to invite Jeff Rollman to help lead us through. He's going to channel his inner Dr. Fernandez, and we will talk some methods questions.
Thank you. Really big shoes to fill, so hard to fill Dr. Fernandez's shoes. But thanks again, Jonathan and Chris, for joining us on here. Definitely great to see your work. Y'all are doing great things at National Registry and in the EMS field. So certainly an honor to have you on here to talk about your study. Y'all already talked a little bit about the goals and objectives of this study and sort of the background on National Registry and what you're doing there. But can you tell us a little bit more about your study design and then what you were able to do at National Registry to try to capture potential subjects for this study for your sample?
Yeah, Chris, do you want to jump on that?
Well, for this sample, this was the simple random survey. So what we did was we evaluate. We have about 300,000 EMTs in the population, about 100 some thousand paramedics in the population. So we actually wanted to do an evaluation to look at these in equal groups. So we tried to pick the same amount of EMTs, the same amount of paramedics. We did a simple random survey. We did some sample calculations. To just try to decide, just trying to get an even group of people to come in to represent the overall National Registry population. like Jonathan said, we have about 500,000 EMS clinicians themselves. They go all the way from EMR all the way to paramedic. There are some civilians in here. There are some military. So we tried to pick out those civilian EMS clinicians that represented your average daily EMS clinician you might run into on the ambulance. So EMTs, paramedics, those are, those are the ones that everybody's going to run into. Those are the biggest populations at the registry. So we did a simple random sample. We know that we're probably going to get about 8 to 10% response rate. It's fairly low if you look at, overall, but that 8 to 10% is still thousands of people. So you're still getting a large sample. The methodology that we use is we use Alkmaar survey. So we selected the people through the central random sample. We put them into Alkmaar. We do the survey in Alkmaar survey. We do the modified Taylor-Dilliman method, which is more or less we send out the initial survey, and then either a week or two later, we'll send out a reminder to the ones who haven't answered it, and then another week or two later, we'll send out another. And so we're just pretty much just trying to get as many people as we can. One thing about a survey, especially if you only get about 8%, is some people look at the survey and they're like, "I'm not doing this. This is I'm not doing this at all." But we really don't know why they're not doing it, right? Did they just select the email and like, screw this, I'm not doing it? Did they select the email? Maybe they got a call, right? Maybe they're on duty. They forgot to go back with it later. Or they, fill out half of it and they kind of drop off and they don't want to do it anymore. So we actually send out what's called a non-responder survey. So for anybody who didn't complete the survey in the first couple iterations of emails, we'll send them a non-responder survey. The non-responder survey just more or less says, are you burned out, right? We actually, instead of giving them all three burnout layers, we gave them just the work-related burnout. So are you burned out in work-related? It's only about, what is, I think it's about 8 questions maybe, instead of maybe like the 20 questions. So we just ask them, are you burned out work-related? And are you planning on leaving in the tw next 12 months? We've actually asked, are you leaving in the next 12 months? Every year, probably since Remley was here, honestly, back in the early 15s, right? Back in the day. So we actually have a longitudinal evaluation of those EMS clinicians over time, which I will not spoil any secrets coming up, but just hint. But anyway, so that's pretty much our methodology and how we did this.
Thank you. Yeah, I can tell you put a lot of thought into this, since even though you have such a large potential sample, we know that a lot of folks are just trying to pay their fees, check the boxes and get through everything really quickly, and they're not necessarily realizing that, hey, we might end up in this great paper a couple of years later. So the fact that you even thought about those non-responders too, that is not very common. Everybody knows that there's these biases, but that you went after that is really thoughtful. And you did a lot of really thoughtful things in your study. Also noticed that you called this survey the EMS Work-Life Survey, and you were very intentional in that name, and we're hoping that that might potentially reduce some of these biases as well. Can you tell us a little bit more about that naming and your thought process behind something that seems simple, but actually was a bit more complex?
Yeah, sure. So anytime that you use a tool to try to get an idea of someone's thought process, there is a lot of thought that goes into the study design of how you ask those questions. And who answers and who doesn't answer those questions definitely impacts the actual results that you get. And so in that way, we wanted to essentially have neutral and or non-inflammatory language that is going to not influence someone one way or another to complete or not complete this survey. We want to give factual information about what the survey is going to be about, with no hints in the lead, no hints in the invitation, but just letting people know this is what we're asking. This is the survey tool. Here's the consent language, and not really have any kind of excess potential bias insertion into that survey as possible. So we want to make sure that whenever we're answering or asking these questions, that we ask them in a way that's going to get the true answer that we're looking for, which is the actual answer to the question. And so what we really want to know is, what are the levels of burnout within these clinicians? What are their workforce intentions? And anything else that really kind of gets in the way of answering those questions could possibly influence and add bias into our study question. And so I like that, we talked about the non-responder a little bit because it's really important whenever you send out 20,000 surveys, if you get 1,500 back, well, that's 18,500 more surveys that you need to have an idea of what's happening, right? And that gives us an idea that the information that we got from our 1,500 surveys is more valid and actually is answering the question that we think that we're asking. And a lot of times with EMS research, I feel like we get away from making sure that our question is valid, that our answer is valid, and that we're really measuring what we think we're measuring and not just throwing out there chaff or numbers that really don't mean anything into the ether. Because the overall intent of this research and all the work that we're doing is to lead to positive change within our profession. And we want to make sure that that change is informed by valid numbers and not numbers that just get pulled out of the sky because of our study sampling strategy or something like that. So all of it is detailing what we're doing, having it out there in clear black and white so that everyone can look and see the decisions that we made, and in places like this, push back and ask why we did what we did, and we can have those types of conversations. I really think that clear methodology is what helps take away that veil and make sure that everyone's working on the same page.
Certainly agree. Yeah, thanks for sharing how thoughtful you were and really how you did your best to try to make sure you were actually able to get good data on these measurements. Going a little bit more to sort of the measuring process, the survey tool you mentioned, and speaking of a burn, I know there's many folks who I could ask, EMS clinicians, and they'll tell me, "Yeah, I'm burnt out." And then you could ask people, "Yeah, I'm dealing with burnout." But we know that you did this much more carefully. It wasn't just are you burnt out or not? So you use the Copenhagen Burnout Inventory, so CBI for short. Can you tell us a little bit more about that CBI, how you chose it, if it's been used in EMS or if it's more used in other settings, and then how it's even kind of scored and applied to this study?
Yeah, sure. So I can hit the easy button here and just say I used it because Dr. Rumley Crowe used it in a similar evaluation back in 2015, 2016. But the more detailed question or the more detailed answer would be that, we're using a validated survey scale. And when I say validated, I mean that this scale has been used in other settings to make sure that it is, to go back to what I said earlier, answering the question that we're really asking. And so you have some burnout scales that are a single question, and they've been validated and show that they can identify burnout quite well. But what we wanted to do was use a larger scale that asked about burnout in a couple other very more targeted areas. And then it's been shown that using those individual target questions as a composite can help us have a better idea or a more true idea as to whether or not the person completing that survey really does have the signs and symptoms of burnout. More specific to this study, as opposed to just a dichotomous, are you burned out? Yes, no. The tool that we use, the Copenhagen Burnout Inventory, specifically breaks it down into three different areas. And whenever we're looking at EMS care, I think these areas were pretty indicative of why we chose it. But one of them is going to be personal burnout. So, what type of burnout do you have in your personal life that does have some type of tie to likely the experiences that you're having in the field? You then also have work-related burnout, which the tie is a lot cleaner there on specifically why we're using that within the EMS field. And then patient-related, right? Because there are differences between the work-related burnout that you might have with work-related processes, things of that sort, and then the work that you're doing with your patient every day. And so these are clear definitions and clear domains of burnout that we wanted to use this more detailed measure in order to get a better idea of what's happening, as opposed to just burnout, yes, no, versus burnout in personal and work-related and in patient-related domains, we felt like gave us a little more specificity in our measure of burnout so that we can really feel good that what we're asking is what we end up getting.
Yeah, and you were super clear on describing all of these in your paper. So certainly commend you. There could be a lot of different ways to define things, but having just that clear definition of what you're looking at, and that extends to your outcomes as well. I mean, you were very clear that those outcomes of interest are your sickness absence and then anticipated profession turnover. But there's a lot of different ways that that could potentially be measured or that you can capture that data. So can you tell us how you actually operationalize those two specific outcomes?
Yeah, sure. I'll talk about sickness absences, then I'll throw it to Chris to talk about intent to lead the EMS profession. But recognizing when we did this survey, it was in the middle of 2022, right? And so the COVID pandemic was not in the rearview mirror. It was really like live with us at the time, right? And so we wanted to look at sickness absence in a couple different ways. One is just general sickness absence, and greater than or less than 10 days was the cutoff that we decided to use in terms of workforce health and stability. And that was sickness absence not related to COVID-19. So then we specifically also wanted to ask about sickness absence related to COVID-19. And for that, we cut down to 5 days. And so we have two sickness-related outcomes here: sickness greater than 10 days over a year, not related to COVID, or sickness absence related to COVID that are 5 or more days per year. Those being our ideas of if we have a positive burnout indicator for a clinician, and they're starting to show these increases in sick time, not necessarily saying that burnout is directly associated with that sick time, but saying that they exist in the same place and they may have some similarities around each other. And so what we're measuring, how we're measuring, getting an idea of how they relate is really kind of the first step before we start throwing it into those complex logistic regression models and all those other different pieces. We need to have an idea of how this is going to play just in a normal 2x2 table. So, Chris, I'll throw it to you for talking about intent to leave the job and the profession.
Yeah, so like I was saying earlier, we've used intent to leave since about 2015. So I mean, it's got about a 10-year progression of people that say their intent to leave, and we usually typically use intent to leave in 12 months, kind of looking at an acute shortage. You know, maybe if something changed recently, and then we use the 5-year to show the people that are leaving in the next 5 years, which obviously is a little bigger than the 12, just because it's longer time frame. So the intent to leave is a 4-part Likert scale. So it's you know, what's your intention to leave in the next 12 months, and it's like highly likely, likely, not likely, very unlikely. And we usually bend it into a likely and an unlikely. And we wanted to look at whether they were likely to leave according to the level of burnout that they experienced. So did they say that they had personal burnout, work-related burnout, or patient-related burnout? Now, the patient-related burnout was actually restricted to only those who provided patient care. So we actually only asked them. So it was, you know, trying to be more specific to those who actually are in using patients. Now you might say, like, why did you look at intentionally versus those who actually left the field? Well, if they left the field, they wouldn't be recertifying. So that would be a different kind of survey that we'd have to do. We'd have to actually survey those who actually left. And so that would be a little bit of a different population. But even the intention to leave is, you know, not healthy in its own. If you are intending to leave your job, sorry about that. If you're intending to leave your job, that really shows like a negative connotation about your current experience. You know, you more likely are probably burn out, which means you don't want to be here anymore. So the intention to leave is really, I don't know, almost like a proxy for burnout, or like wanting to, you know, like you want to leave your profession, you want to leave, and it's not leave your agency, it's actually leave the EMS profession. So it's almost like the next step up. You're not transferring to be an educator or something like that. You're getting out of EMS. So we try to be specific to actually people that have really a negative connotation on EMS, and you know, so and that's why we use that for the analysis and for the burnout analysis, kind of the comparison or the looking for associations between those two.
Yeah, and to back up what Chris was saying, you know, this also represents a population that is almost intervenable, right? These are people with the intent to leave their job within the next 12 months, or leave the profession within the next 12 months. These are people that we theoretically could intervene upon and could show that if we are making demonstrable strides to improving this, then maybe we won't lose that person from the workforce. So another just different layer of it, and trying to figure out what these different populations mean and who the best is to measure.
And to add one more, the non-responder, if you have people that actually have higher intention to leave or higher burnout on the non-responder, you know, that's even worse. That says that whatever your evaluation is that you got in your main study, good or bad, that your intention to leave is probably even higher and your burnout's even higher if you get different results in those people that didn't answer the initial survey.
Yeah, I think those all make a lot of sense and really good questions that you're asking and really clearly explaining. Again, I can't thank you enough for clearly explaining all these different outcomes, your two key research questions that you evaluated, those are clearly explained. Number one being the prevalence of burnout among EMS clinicians, and number two, the association between burnout and workforce reducing factors. And now, kind of the drum roll leading into the results. I think now is a perfect time to bring in table one, because my last question sort of gets us into the results. And one of the powers of this National Registry Survey is you also get a lot of good demographic measures that are already captured as part of that renewal recertification process. So I was wondering if you could just tell us about some of these different factors and measures that are already included that we can include.
Yeah. So
And
it's
then also, sorry, I was going to add
oh.
in the curveball. We know what's in there, but was there anything that's not in there that you would have think you would love to have one or two extra, maybe demographic variables that you weren't able to measure as well?
I'll tell you about the variables that are in there. I'll let Jonathan take a second to look through to see if there's anything else it could have been. So one thing about the National Registry is when you get the survey, it's already linked with your profile at the National Registry. So when you complete the survey, we get it, we download it, and then we link it with the 10 profile questions that are a part of the National Registry survey. So we already ask you in another section, how many years of experience? We already have that. We already have your sex or your gender. We have your race and ethnicity. We have your agency type. We have your service type. We have all these things. So these are things that are easily put together into the survey, and that's one way to keep the survey shorter because the person who's actually doing it doesn't have to repeat all these this information. But on the other hand, that's a way for us to always be able to link people over time. To know that if, they change jobs and stuff like that, if we were doing any kind of longitudinal evaluation. As far as the other question, Jonathan might have some. I know we did shift length and weekly call volume, but again, these kind of go towards things that might be associated with burnout. So we wanted to see, these are also more of the intervenable things as far as, like is a call volume or a shift length more associated with burnout, which is an obvious choice trying to look at things that you would be able to intervene on. Jonathan, you have anything else?
Yeah, I'll take some stuff on the beginning of table one. I'll say this, the demographic profile of this sample is rather similar to the overall demographic profile of the National Registry. And so that's one of the big pieces to take away from table one is getting an idea of the sample of people that we pulled from this overall database. Do they reflect those in the database themselves? And then does that database reflect the overall demographics of the profession itself, right? And so I can say that these are rather similar to what we see across the National Registry database. We have majority male, majority white, non-Hispanic, majority FIRE. Now, I will say that FIRE is actually a smaller proportion in this data set than it is in the overall data set, where it's higher towards maybe 45-ish percent. And so there might be a decrease of FIRE influence on this data set than there would be in others. One thing on the next part of table one, speaking of weekly call volume, we mentioned how a lot of the work that Remley did informed this paper. And specifically for weekly call volume, that's something that they measured. And whenever they measured it back in 2015, 2016, the top weekly call volume bin was 20 plus calls. And that was the majority of the calls. Whenever we measured this, we found that we needed to create a new bin, and that was greater than or equal to 30 calls. And you can notice that that greater than or equal to 30 calls overall is 24% of total of the total people that were included in the survey. And so, beyond the burnout pieces, just pulling out simple demographic differences, we're seeing much, much higher call volume on a weekly basis for clinicians than we were seeing 10 years ago. And so that's something just to think about in the overall, distribution of EMS care. It's changing, right? And so there's no reason that the other pieces, burnout, intent to leave the workforce, shouldn't be changing. And so to me, like this table one really just kind of reiterates the fact that a one and done approach to any of these things is not the way to go. We have to systematically and continuously assess these pieces, because if we don't know that, then we might be measuring things wrong when we remeasure something 10 years in the future, right? And so, kind of a dynamic change, that is kind of what this is showing.
Yeah.
On the back end of table one, it talks about our outcomes, and that will be sickness absence due to COVID and not due to COVID, as well as intent to leave the EMS job. What I want to show is just one that across the board, it does seem like EMTs and paramedics have differences when it comes to sickness absences and intent to leave the profession. And so what you tend to see is that intent to leave the job, you actually see a higher proportion of those at the EMT level at 34% intending to leave their job compared to paramedics at 27%. Versus intent to leave the profession within 12 months, it's 19% of EMTs being likely versus 15% of those that are paramedics. And so just looking at the raw 2x2 table here, we're getting an idea that EMTs might be leaving the profession at a higher rate, or at least considering to do that, than paramedics. And why that might be, we can't be certain right now, but something to do with the potential for scope of practice changes, for additional education that you've had to put into this, those could all be pieces as to why paramedics might be leaving the workforce at a or have intent to leave the workforce at a lower rate. Whenever Chris and the rest of the registry does their intent to leave the workforce work, a lot of times that can be differential by EMT and paramedic level, but there are other pieces that do come into play here. But that's really all that I have to kind of pull out about table one. We could spend a lot more time on it, but I know that we have other things to talk about, so I'll kind of abridge.
Well, thank you so much for sharing all that. And I know that the reviewers could definitely hound you right away and say, "Hey, you only got 9% of the sample to respond. How do you know this is reflective?" And seeing that it actually meets those general trends that you see in the larger sample is definitely gives us a lot more confidence in those results that you very carefully thought through how to obtain them. So before we go any further, we could go on methods all day long, but wanted to see if any of the other panelists on the podcast had any questions about the methods or introduction or the first table.
I don't have so much a question, but a couple of comments. And first is to give these authors huge kudos on the methodology, because I survey methodology is one of those things that's deceivingly difficult to do well. A lot of times we see the surveys on Facebook or somebody's pushing it out through an email chain, and they have great intent, but those are what we call a convenient sample. And having a true sampling frame, so they had a pool to grab from and to grab randomly from, is a huge benefit and gives us a lot more belief in this study. And these things are actually really challenging. They did a great job at thinking about how much do I need to inflate the sample to know that I'm going to have enough participants. We know the historic response rates are low, but they've planned for that ahead of time. And the results show this. We've got over 1,800 completed surveys, which is a huge number for survey methodology, and their thoughtfulness in how they sent that survey out. So not creating bias with a survey name. So if I put a survey on Facebook today that says, "Come take my survey on EMS burnout and why supervisors are the worst," I'm going to get very strong feedback in one direction or another. Whereas if the National Registry sends me an email saying, "Hey, take my work-life survey," I'm not likely to be tipped off on what that topic is, and so not more likely to respond in one way or another. So I just really wanted to highlight that for those who are undertaking this kind of work, that survey methods are hard, and you should consult with excellent survey methodologists like Jonathan and Chris early and often. There's my PSA soapbox for the day. I'll turn it over to Mr. Caduce. You got a question?
Yeah, absolutely. I pretty much have on my wall, consult your methodologist on a regular basis, frequent and often, I believe. Before I will forget to make the mention before we get into the next table. So I just wondered, because it's my anecdotal experience that we're seeing a lot more EMTs enter the workforce as an entry-level position for the next thing, right? Maybe it's paramedic school, maybe it's firefighting, maybe it's nursing school, pre-med, the gamut, right? Do you think that might play into why we see them being more likely to leave the workforce as it's much more entry level than our paramedic clinicians?
I definitely think EMT is much more of an entry level position. Obviously, the people that want to, continue around go on to be a paramedic. So a lot of times you do have that transition, you do have that more buy-in, you've done more education, more work to get into the position. Obviously, like Jonathan said earlier, our National Registry population is about mid-40s% firefighter. So we actually have a large population of EMTs because they get it as a firefighter. That's kind of their position. They just do EMT firefighter, and they don't go on to get their paramedic. So, it depends on the population, the agency, different roles, different certification levels are going to have different roles there. A lot of times people that go on to be like admin or go up in their ranks, they're more paramedics. So we do typically see paramedics sticking around a little longer than EMTs in all of our surveys.
Yeah, I'll jump on top of that a little bit too, just on the side of more research is needed. We know precious little about EMT educational programs, let alone EMT intent. So the mindset around those that are EMTs, their career goals, their aspirations, the inputs that move them from one area to another, we know precious little about that. And so while that veil is kind of being lifted on the paramedic side a little bit, it's still very murky on the EMT side. So I think that's a very good opportunity to say more work is done and more work in that area specifically.
But stand by, it's coming.
Awesome. That helped reinforce my own experiences.
Love it when my biases are confirmed. Thanks.
Exactly. My bias is accurate.
Perfect. I think before we move from table one that I these findings to me immediately off the bat were disturbing. So to see that more than 1 out of 10 paramedics is contemplating leaving the profession within the next year. And 1 out of 5 EMTs contemplating to leave the profession for whatever reasons, whether that's stair-stepping into another career, whatever it might be. But this is a big burden on the workforce and for workforce planning, a really key finding. But I do want to move us to, I guess, the drum roll moment. I want to talk about burnout. And so, Jonathan, I'll turn it over to you to walk us through what we're seeing with regards to objective number one, looking at the prevalence of burnout in each domain. And perhaps you can comment a little bit on how this matches up to the previous work that was done.
Yeah, would love to. So first off, whenever you think about results, a lot of times words that come to mind are interesting or fascinating, and I feel like using those words for looking at burnout and EMS clinicians, knowing what it means to be tough to say and almost inappropriate. And so if those words come out, it's not to specifically talk about this information, because what we found was really sobering, I think. And so to remind y'all, we're looking at burnout in three different divisions: personal related burnout, work related burnout, and patient related burnout. And over our entire sample, over 1800 clinicians, over half indicated that they had symptoms of personal and work related burnout, and just over a fifth indicated that they had indications of patient-related burnout. And so whenever we split that up into paramedic and EMTs, we see that paramedics have a higher incidence, or excuse me, prevalence of both personal, work-related, and patient-related burnout compared to EMTs. And so what that looks like is, our paramedics are showing 54% of our sample with personal-related burnout, 52% with work-related burnout, and then 27% with patient-related burnout. Those are sobering amounts that one of every two clinicians that we spoke to had personal and work-related burnout, and then just under, a third, we're looking at patient-related burnout. What does that do to the patient care that we're delivering? What does that do to the ability for our clinicians to be empathetic and compassionate and to really be the best version of themselves whenever they are dealing with symptoms of burnout that are multifactorial and likely need to be addressed? And to your point, Remley, thinking about the work that you all did 2015, 2016, we've seen personal and work-related burnout double. These were percentages that were in the 20s and in the 30s for your work, and patient-related burnout was around 13%. And now we've seen it kick up to about 23% of the sample. And so what this really paints is a picture of a profession that prior to the COVID-19 pandemic was struggling and was showing signs of burnout in all three of these divisions. We have the COVID-19 pandemic, we have the response, we have the continued response and allostatic load that's just continuing to build up in clinicians, and we don't see a lessening of these symptoms. We don't see a sign of things getting better despite widespread recognition that this is a problem. And so what this kind of signals to me is that, one, we recognize that this is a problem based off of your great work that you did previously. But two, we also need to recognize that what we've done in response to that hasn't really moved the needle. And if anything, it has contributed to a state of play where the needle is getting further and further behind, and we're getting closer and closer to empty, and there's no gas station in sight, right? And so what I kind of want this to be able to do is to just paint the picture and show that we were struggling prior to the largest incidents of one of the largest health-related pandemics in modern history, and we're still struggling, and whatever we're doing isn't working. And so we need to find some way to intervene, some way to measure this in a way that leads to meaningful change, or at least movement towards trying to find that change. And I recognize that that probably got super dark super quick, but it's really difficult to talk about numbers like these in a positive and uplifting fashion, except for the fact that I'm excited about where we can go. I'm excited about what we can do and next steps. And so that's where we want to go next, is thinking about what this means and how we can intervene.
And one thing to add on to that is just the elephant in the room is the last column over there to the right is the non-responder. So if you had regular burnout of 50% in your total population, when you send out that non-responder survey and just say, okay, you didn't answer any of these previous surveys, so we know something's up. Maybe we're just going to ask you just a smaller one, like, are you burned out? Just do the work related burnout and then your intentional leave. And we actually had a higher number of people that were on the non-responder survey, which probably meant they were too burned out to answer the original survey. And now you have all these other people that actually may have a higher level of burnout in those 18,000-ish people that Jonathan was talking about earlier that actually didn't answer the survey. So that's honestly almost more striking than the original numbers, just that you might have more people that actually are more burned out that did not answer your survey.
You hit the nail on the head on what I wanted to pull in here. And I think Jonathan used the word sobering. That's a good word for this. My first thought was disturbing, or they made an error in the code because I'm always the cynic over here. And hey, let me see this. Let's look through. Oh, they must have told them the survey topic or something went sideways here. There's no way that these numbers have changed that much since that original work was completed. But no, the non-responder survey gives us that gut check to say, I would expect that people that don't answer the first time could be more likely to experience symptoms of burnout and less likely to volunteer their time and energy into answering a survey for a national certification body. So what these findings are incredibly disturbing. And I look at the patient-related burnout here, and it causes me great pause and great concern, because one thing is I'm annoyed with my working conditions, I'm annoyed with my supervisor, I'm annoyed with hours, whatever. But to the questions that go into that patient-related scale are worth reviewing. And that's, I'm genuinely annoyed by having to work with patients, and I'm so cynical at this point that I may not be taking their complaints at face value, or I start to think everybody is just abusing the system, and these can have real implications on patient care. So for me, that was probably the largest takeaway from this, is seeing nearly one out of four EMS clinicians experiencing patient-related burnout is a sign that we need an intervention, and hopefully this was an artifact of the pandemic and that we see this taper off, but it is certainly something to pay attention to.
Jonathan and Chris, I just wondered what feedback you've gotten from EMS clinicians. I think, as an outside observer, I would agree that the word sobering, jarring, concerning all come to mind. As an EMS provider, I sort of think, like, yeah, this seems about right.
Yeah, unfortunately, that seems to be the natural gut check that appears to be happening. When presenting this data, a lot of times I'll do a stacked bar chart where the first stack are all of Remley's data from her study and say, all right, now 8, 10 years later, here where we are. And then you see the doubling, right? And while you had the initial sit back and the next step is, yeah, that seems about right. And so my experience is very similar to yours.
And honestly, it's pretty easy with 50% there. That means pretty much every time you walk up to two EMS clinicians, one of them's burned out. So it's easy to get buy-in from the EMS clinician to say, yeah, that's right. I mean, we're burned out. We're tired. NMSIS numbers have went from 17 million when Remley did her study back in 2015. They're over 54 million right now. I mean, people just call EMS, and when the population of your EMS clinicians does not rise to the level of meeting the needs of these callers that are calling 911, I mean, burnout is going to get higher. I mean, there's no way around it. And everybody knows that our satisfaction survey that we did, our study that we did, our leaving evaluation, I mean, people are just anytime you do a social media video, or you post it on LinkedIn or whatever, it's always, burnout, pay us more, we're tired of all these extra patients and stuff. So it's definitely understandable that everybody's going through this, unfortunately.
Hi there.
Absolutely. Hey, Bill.
Thank you, authors. I appreciate it. It's nice work, nice to read. Do
Thank
we
you.
know enough about the people entering the workforce? And I know you touched on it, but to me, that seems to be a missing piece. Are people coming into the workforce with their baggage that could affect their long term in the profession?
Yeah, that's a great question, Bill. That's the problem with the cross sectional, right? You just get this one snapshot. You really don't know any temporal, you know, were they problematic, I guess you say, before they come in. Unfortunately, the National Registry, the only time we're able to do initial clinician certificate or any kind of survey would be when they initially get that first certification, right? Because we would not know any of their information before then. And with most of our work that we do, unless it's a simple random sample like we did here in this project, we do recertification surveys. So we would actually ask them after 2 years of being in or at their first recertification, you know, we would evaluate them at this point for leaving. Sometimes we do burnout questions, sometimes we do satisfaction, and so we would ask them then. So we have not really reached out and asked people about their previous history before they come in. That might be a little controversial or, you know, like a sensitive topic, you know, were you depressed before you came in? You know, did you have, you know, feelings of burnout? So that would be interesting. I'm not sure that we have the database right now or the survey tools to be able to answer that question.
I don't disagree with you. I'm thinking, you know, co-amps, but that's only going to take care of advanced EMTs potentially and paramedics. You know, it's something that would have to be, I think, worked out at the state level, you know, to help with that kind of information. But I still believe that people bring their past. It's natural
sure.
into what our profession is. The question is what impact might or might that not have? So it's just, it's always something I've wondered is that, are we looking where we need to look soon enough or early enough to begin to put the interventions in that could help minimize it down the road?
Yeah, I understand the comparison that you're making, and I think that the methodology that we used helped us to somewhat put those on an even playing field, right? So using the exact same methodology that our Remley's paper used in the same data source, theoretically across those simple random samples, the distribution of previous experiences should be rather random, the same as the other pieces that we're looking to examine here. So had we used, you know, different databases or something of that sort, I could see where the thought process of these might have a different type of experience than those in the other database, but by using this similar methods, we mitigated that as much as we possibly can. But from an intervention standpoint, that's going to take a lot more qualitative work as well as quantitative to get an idea of what those look like. So, really good question.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. When I was undertaking this work early on, I had similar thoughts. Is does this profession attract folks who bring more potential concerns from their personal lives? And I think that is where the three dimensions here also helps. And specifically looking at, okay, personal has a certain flair, but work influences personal life as well, as we all know. But looking at that work-related one, if we really look at those items and the time frame on it is tight, it's over the past 4 weeks when that question is asked, there's definitely more in this picture. And that's the next question I wanted to bring in is, burnout is so often treated like a personal issue. And this is why I took this on as my dissertation project, because I feel strongly I disagree with this. There's other findings here that suggest otherwise. And Jonathan and Chris, interested in your thoughts on, you know, what are the systems factors that we should be thinking about? Because is the solution really to tell burned out me to do some more yoga? Is that really going to help this on a big national level?
Yeah, so the answer is going to be, you know, what an epidemiologist would say is the cop out, right? It depends. And the reason I say it depends is by the data that we have, we're very limited in that we can look at things within a very small snapshot within a small period of time and we're limited by collecting all the additional pieces that might be a part of that overall relationship, right? So your job satisfaction, organizational culture at your agency, ways of addressing burnout, all of those pieces kind of float in the ether and I think have that impact on the clinician, both from the personal sense and the systemic sense. And so what I think would help to push in the direction of your question is more of that prospective thought process of how do we design a intervention, design an assessment tool that lets us get an idea of all the things that we know are a part of that relationship. And so that we're not just saying, we're going to fix satisfaction here, we're going to fix culture here, we're going to fix burnout there. And then no one talks to each other and it's all interdependent and they get in each other's way, right? And so I really think some of the work that's coming out of the National Registry in the next few years in terms of prospectively looking at EMS clinicians, their workforce, and their health are going to help to look at that because we're recognizing now with all of these analyses that it's not all one thing and that we really have to take all the individual disparate pieces and look at it as a whole so that we can know how those areas kind of interact. And to your point, Remley, how the systemic pieces interact with those potential personal pieces, what has more of a loading and what's going to be the best place for us to intervene. It's likely not going to be individual yoga. It might be a systemic level intervention by an agency or by a state to support those clinicians using evidence-based background as opposed to pizza parties and yoga.
I like both of those things, though. It can be a both and. No, I think you hit the nail on the head and answered very well as an epidemiologist. All right, now I have an unpopular task to keep us on track. So, Jeff Rollman, I'll give you the second to last question. We'll give the authors the last word.
Thank you. Thank you. And agreed, this work was so powerful and you so clearly explained these findings, but it's so important that we don't just dwell on kind of the methods and these results, but what are we actually doing about it? And I know you definitely talked about interventions and moving forward, but there's so many different kind of regulators and overseers of EMS. I'm was wondering your thoughts on where to go. Is this something that should start at a federal level, a state level, regional EMS, individual agency, your shift supervisor? Who do you think would be the best audience potentially to bring this to and to get started on these interventions?
Yeah, so I'll answer your question. Any resources that you have available? Yes. Please, yes, give them. Overall, what this work has kind of pointed at is the fact that these individual levels of burnout absolutely have an impact on sickness days and leaving the field. And so burnout has an associational tie to workforce health and stability. And so when you think about it from what can we lever, what can we intervene on? In this case, burnout would be the piece that we would want to intervene upon. And that's going to lead to one, agencies being aware that this is a factor, agencies being aware that it's possible that within one in two of their clinicians are suffering from some type of work-related or personal-related burnout, and understanding how that is really going to impact the care that's delivered every day. And I think the answer is that's a local, that's an agency, that's a state, and that's a federal response. And I think working within, the devolved federalism system that we have, a lot of the power kind of rests with the states, with that federal funding and that federal knowledge that this is a problem. And so I'll say the solution is likely twofold. And one being recognition that this is an issue, recognition that this issue has a direct impact on the care that we're giving to patients and the availability of clinicians to deliver that care. That is recognizing that there is a gap and a need to intervene. And then two is the pushing the resources to those who are going to use evidence-based ways to look at this. One of the great things about our federalism system within the United States is that we have 50 individual laboratories of democracy with the opportunity to pour resources into this problem. And so there's not one thing that's going to be right, but through assessing, through intervening, and through looking to try to actually address the problem rather than just talk about it, we're going to have the successful pieces rise to the top and allow us to take those lessons and apply them to other systems. So I'm a big policy guy. I'm big on using those laboratories of democracy to drive change. And I think this is an opportunity for us to really engage and push that ability to intervene as opposed to just talk about it. So I hope that answered your question.
Absolutely. I think that is strong concluding remarks, but I will give each of you the opportunity if there's any one key takeaway or message you'd like to leave our audience with. And so, Chris, I can start with you, and we'll give Jonathan the last word, and I will take us out of here.
Yeah. As far as this survey and all the other surveys we do here at the Nash Registry, I'm so glad to be a part of this organization. Honestly, I just really want to pitch more for our research overall. The Nash Registry has haters and lovers, right? The haters are usually on the certification side, and the lovers are more on the research side. We try to do so much work for the EMS clinicians throughout the United States. And I'm just so happy to be a part of this, trying to make EMS just the profession that I've been a part of for 20 years, more than 20 years now, because I know there are so many people out there that want to do this job. They have such love for EMS in general and the patients, especially when they start off. And we just want to make it better overall, and eventually hope it's a place that, people just love to come to and, love being a part of this work to get it there, hopefully.
I mean, I love taking a computer adaptive test. I don't know what you're talking about, but I think that's
Exactly.
exactly. Jonathan, last words or thoughts?
First, I'm just thankful for the opportunity to share this work with your audience and to talk about it with you all. I think this kind of comes down to two things being important: one, measurement, and two, intervention. The measurement piece, we're trying to provide that framework for measurement, right? This is an open access article. This is an article that shows everything that we did, why we did it, and provides you with those tools so that you can then go and use it yourself and apply it to your agency, to your state, to your clinician base in order to get an idea of what's happening within the clinicians at your agency. And two, measurement isn't enough. We have to do something with those measurements. And so we can talk about what we've done, but to really try to work with those that have the power to intervene, to work with those that are going to not only see a number, but see the implication and the necessity of intervention on that number is incredibly important. And so the more that we can talk about these things, the more that we can bring them out to discuss with the EMS community in settings like this. I'm just overjoyed to be able to share this information and hopefully lead to meaningful change. So thank y'all.
Well, we want to thank you very much. Huge kudos and thanks to both of our authors. We are very appreciative of your dedication to the study. This was not an easy lift, and I know that having lived it. Very much appreciate your ongoing dedication to the profession and helping push forward the well-being of the EMS workforce. We're really lucky to have you all as part of the fellowship and part of the profession. So thanks for sharing your time with us today. I do have that unpopular task of wrapping up this latest episode of the Pre-Hospital Care Journal Club. So before we go, I want to remind you all that the educational version of this podcast will be happening Friday, June 27th. And then we'll be back here with the clinical version on the second Monday of the month, which will be July 14th. Thanks, all of you in the audience, for listening. And we look forward to nerding out a little bit more next time. So thank you all.
We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at pcrfpodcast.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website, prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsors, Limmer Education, providing educational tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey, and ESO, dedicated to improving community health and safety through the power of data. Thank you.